Hey everybody, it's Adam, live and in person for you. Hey everybody, it's Adam, wonder who he'll interview.
Hey everyone, it's Call Me Adam, broadcasting on the Broadway Podcast Network. On today's episode of Burying It All with Call Me Adam, I am recording at the Houdini Museum in New York City with director Carl Andress, whose longtime collaboration with Tony nominee Charles Bush is continuing at the Cherry Lane Theater with Charles's hilarious new show, The Confession of Lily Dare, running through March 5th. Hi, Carl.
Hey, Adam. It's great to see you.
It's great to see you. We are going to start with The Confession of Lily Dare, which you are currently directing.
That's right.
So, like I just mentioned, it's playing at the Cherry Lane Theater. And before we get into the actual show itself, let's just start a little bit with about you.
Okay.
So my listeners can get to know you a little bit. So who or what inspired you to become a director?
Well, I grew up in Nashua, New Hampshire, and going to theater all the time. My mother was an actress and a singer. She was actually Miss New Hampshire in the 1969 Miss America pageant.
Oh, wow.
But she was from New York City. She grew up in Brooklyn and Queens and eventually Long Island. But when she was 16 years old, my grandfather moved 10 of his 14 children to New Hampshire for a job. He had to take a job. And so she was doing her senior year of high school in a completely different state.
Wow.
And she really spoke with a Brooklyn accent. And when she got into the pageants, quite accidentally, she thought she was signing up for something else that was just a local little fun thing. Turned out it was actually for the local Miss Nashua pageant. And then she won. She's a singer. And she won. And then she was going to the Miss New Hampshire pageant, and she won. And so then when she was going to Miss America, they really couldn't have Miss New Hampshire sound like she was from Brooklyn, New York. So they gave her, you know, some speech help to make her, you know, sort of iron out that Brooklyn accent. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so, you know, theater was in our blood. And my father was a newspaper man in New Hampshire, and he is a big theater fan too. And mm-hmm. they would go to Boston to see tryouts. In fact, when I was a little kid, I grew up like seeing their playbills. They went to see Company and Follies,
oh my
like
God.
In their out of town tryouts.
Wow.
You know? So they were there.
Yes.
You know? So I sort of always had that fascination. My mother was very involved in the local theater scene, mm-hmm. and my father became a critic and for the newspaper he worked for. So we were seeing things all the time in Boston and the greater Boston area. And I became really fascinated with seeing how shows were put together. You know, my mother was in them, but then I would go to rehearsals with her and I would help paint scenery and I would see what rehearsals were like and how the shows all sort of came together, really starting at the age of 3.
Wow.
You know, they were doing Lil Abner and my mother was on the props committee and her best friend was playing Daisy May and I was taken to the show. And I guess I fell asleep at intermission and my father took me home. And as soon as I realized I was home, I was furious and wouldn't go to sleep because I did not know how the story ended.
Oh my
God. And I wouldn't go to sleep until my mother came home and told me how the story ended. So as I grew up, you know, I was just sort of fascinated by all that. But, you know, I think there comes a time where you sort of, especially back then in the 70s and 80s, you sort of, your way into the theater was through acting. You could audition. Mm-hmm. You could get into a play at school
right.
or locally. And so I started off that way and always sort of thought I'd want to be an actor. But then as I went through college, I think my mind just sort of expanded a little bit more in wanting to do that. And then subsequently, after college, after being on the road, I went and did sort of a children's theater tour with American Family Theater, Aladdin, for about a year, and eventually landed in New York. And subsequently met Charles Bush, and well, that's a whole other story.
And, yeah, we're going to get to
that. We'll get to that. And it was after sort of being in his circle for a couple years where he sort of knew I wanted to be an actor, but really sort of said, kid, I think you're a director.
Mm.
And once that door was open to me, I sort of never wanted to look back.
Wow. I love that.
Yeah.
And I love that he had that intuition to be like, this is what you're calling
it. It's really special when somebody sees you.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all look for that
yes.
in our friends and our relationships and our families. We want to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people see things in you that you don't really know are there until they make you aware of where your gifts really might lie.
Yes, yes. So how did you meet Charles Bush when you landed in New York?
I feel like one of the luckiest people in the theater, simply because I met Charles about 6 months after moving to New York City.
Wow.
Yeah, there was a show playing called Swing Time Canteen that he wrote the book for, mm-hmm. and it was starring Allison Frazier and Emily Lesser. And it was a really fun off-Broadway musical that I actually at the time couldn't afford to go and see, because I had a series of crazy jobs. You know, I was working at I was an office temp. I worked at a fudge store, Hershey's Fudge, in the City Corps Center. I had to dress up once a week as Fudgy the Bear and hand out samples by the elevator bank. Dignity, always dignity.
We all do it. We all do it. I had to dress up as a moose one time and walk around CVS.
So. Oh, I did Clifford the Big Red Dog, you know. Oh, goodness. What else did I? Oh, and I worked at Starbucks. I so did not want to be sort of like in working in like an office, mm-hmm. or in like the agency, because I really wanted to be like sort of in show business,
yes.
In the creative side of things. So I wasn't really satisfied with like being like, you know, in the office.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't even occur to me about like being in a producer's office or a general manager's office. It was just sort of like, I didn't want to be in an agent's office.
Yes.
And so I wanted to have that freedom to be able to go and audition. And I just miraculously got this phone call. It was probably around Memorial Day, where a friend of mine who had graduated from my college, University of New Hampshire, about 10 years before me. And when he had come, I had been working in the theater as sort of like, they called us technical assistants.
Mm-hmm.
And we were involved in working on all aspects of the technical aspects of the theater. So you would have to work in the lighting department. You'd have to work in the scenic department. You'd have to work in the costume department. And I sort of met him when we were doing some production. Maybe it was Into the Woods. And
mm-hmm.
I was responsible for creating Rapunzel's hair. And so I met him. And so by the time I was in New York, I'd let him know. And he called me up and he said, listen, a friend of mine's a company manager on this off-Broadway musical. They're looking to replace their wardrobe person. I know it's not an acting job, but it's in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you should go and interview for this. And at least you get to see the show for free.
Yes.
So I took him up on that. I got to see the show for free. I fell in love with it. And then as I was speaking with the woman who I would replace, the wardrobe person, I was just saying how I was such a fan of Allison Frazier, and I'd read all of Charles Bush's plays, and had read his novel, and knew, you know, what everything I could about their company, you know, Theater in Limbo. And the costume designer was Robert McIntosh, who had designed the costumes for MAME on Broadway. You know, so I was just like so into it. Well, I guess she figured she had a real live wire here. So she recommended me to the general manager, and unbeknownst to me, she just said, oh, can you come back tomorrow for the matinee and just shadow me during the matinee? I said, sure.
Wow.
So when I showed up, the company manager said, well, why are you here? And before I could answer, she said, well, he so wants this job that he asked if he could shadow me. And so then they went into Allison and they said, all right, you've met these candidates, you know, who would you like? And she said, hire the boy.
Oh, wow. That's
bathe
so great.
Him and bring him to me. And and it was just, she, you know, I guess maybe they said, you know, he is a fan.
Yeah.
You know, and so then I met her and she became a really good friend, and she was with the show for another few months. And then subsequently she was going off to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And Charles took over and replaced her in the show. And I thought he was going to have his own dresser, a big retinue of staff, you know, and he just sort of showed up one day for the photo shoot, you know, with a wig in one shopping bag and a dress in the other shopping bag. And, you know, and I'd written him a letter, you know, asking him to come to a reading of a play I was doing. And he said yes.
Oh, my God.
And he just sort of showed up, and we became sort of immediate friends, sort of protege mentor. And then, you know, as we put him into the show, we became really good friends.
That's amazing.
And for the next 2 years, he would ask my advice on, he was appearing in a gala or a benefit, and should he, if he was performing, and it's like, should he be in drag? Should he not be in drag? What should he wear? All of these sort of things. And we just sort of started having this dialogue about show business stuff. And before long, about 2 years, he wanted to do a new play, and he said he was going to write me a part in it.
Wow!
And then we talked about the story so much that he subsequently said, well, I think we should do this play. And he got us a booking at the WPA Theater and got it set up so that we could direct it together.
Oh my God.
And he said, kid, I think you're a director. And so you'll be in this play and we'll direct it together and we'll put it on. And I ended up really sort of taking on more of the responsibility of directing. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, was really focusing on his performance as a star.
Yes.
And writing. And together we put on this show called Queen Amarantha at the WPA Theater. And it was not exceptionally well received. You know, mm-hmm. people wanted it to be funnier. We mm-hmm. were just really doing a melodrama. And we were sort of like really going at it like this was very BAM, very public theater. Yes. But, you know, I think there was an expectation that it wanted to be funnier just because it was a melodrama and was sort of, you know, inspired by a Garbo film called Queen Christina. Mm. So, you know, we learned our lesson and we, you know, we had that experience. And then subsequently, the next year, we want to do something else. And Charles said to me, all right, so do you want to be in this one or you just want to direct it? I said, I just want to direct it. And I really knew that I didn't want to pursue an acting career anymore. I really just wanted to focus on being a director. And so that next play that we worked on became Shanghai Moon.
Oh my God. Yeah. What a great way to like get right into it and to be able to work with someone so illustrious as Charles. I mean, from the get-go, like from both really the start of his career, your career.
Like I said, I mean, I was probably like 23 or 24 years old.
Wow.
So I was very young. But when you have somebody who believes in you, and he sort of adopted me right into his family, like, you know, he and his partner sort of like, you know, were very encouraging to me and making me feel like I belonged and had a sense of family in New York. Same thing with his sisters. Mm. And then his friends, you know, his group of friends subsequently sort of became my friends. And we were just all sort of connected in this way. And therefore, and that continues on to this day, you know, like with our cast, with mm-hmm. our designers, with people who work on our shows, we sort of all become an extended family and we always kind of go back to the same group.
Yes.
As I think, you know, you notice.
I do. Yes. I was going to say it's so like Jennifer Van Dyke, who's in The Confession of Lily Dare. I mean, she was in Divine Sister, Third Story.
We met her on the Third Story.
Yeah.
We had a real hard time finding somebody to play that role, Dr. Constance Hudson,
mm-hmm.
who had a very long monologue, very detailed monologue in the second act. And we were having a hard time finding just the right person. And we had already cast our leading man, Jonathan Walker.
Yes.
And
her husband.
Her husband. But we didn't know her yet.
Mm.
And so Charles was talking to Julie Halston, dear friend, and said, you know, we're having a hard time casting this role. And she said, well, you know, Jonathan, your leading man, is married to the most wonderful actress. You ought to call her in. So we had the casting office bring her in. And I think Charles and I both remember this, that she got, you know, like two sentences into the monologue and we were like, hire her, beg her, please. Will she do it? Will she come to La Jolla? And sure enough, she did. And now it's, I think it's like 11 years later, mm-hmm. and I think we've done like over a dozen projects together with various productions of the plays mm-hmm. and readings and benefits and things, and she's just one of the greatest gifts.
Yeah, she's phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, I love how you do keep sort of a quote-unquote company of actors for all the various shows. I mean, Allison, too, has been in numerous
shows. Yeah.
Yeah, and Julie, like you said.
And sometimes it's, you know, oftentimes Charles will have an idea and he'll sort of tailor a part mm-hmm. for a certain actor.
Yeah.
And hopefully they can do it. Sometimes they can't. Sometimes we have the booking and somebody's not available.
Right.
Or they are. And we sort of try to maintain that and then keep tailoring the piece, you know, the role to the piece
yes.
and to them. And it's just, it makes for a very lovely working environment.
Yeah. And it makes for a great presentation from an audience standpoint, because I always am so happy when I see, whether it's Julie, Allison, Jennifer, Jonathan, I mean, there's so many I could rattle
that's
off,
a
but
lot, yeah.
that's, I would say the core group. I'm always excited when they're in one of your shows. I mean,
yeah,
it's
we
just
love
fantastic.
It when it works out, you know, and then sometimes it doesn't work out, but you know, we have the booking, we have to,
right.
have to do the show,
right.
but it's, you know, there'll be another one.
Okay. Before we really get into The Confession of Lily Dare. So one thing I do notice, which I know you mentioned, so some shows that you and Charles have together, you don't have reviewers come
mm-hmm.
and others you do. So how do you decide which ones you want to invite reviewers to and which ones you don't? Before we get to that answer, let's take a quick break and get a word in from one of our sponsors. We'll be back in a minute. Oh, wait. You don't know? You haven't heard? You must not be subscribed to the Call Me Adam Digest. When you sign up for the Call Me Adam Digest, you are the first to know. You get a front row seat to my interviews and podcast episodes, where you get to discover new things about your favorite celebrities. You get personal stories from the other side of the microphone that you wouldn't know by just reading, watching, or listening to my interviews. We get to have a weekly connection, and you can add some fun to your weekend. So come take a peek behind the curtain with the Call Me Adam Digest. Sign up today at callmeadam.com. Can't wait to see you there. Welcome back to Burying It All with Call Me Adam. So as you were saying...
Well, whenever we start one of our plays at Theater for the New City, that's mm-hmm. typically just meant as an exercise to have a good time, to mm-hmm. have fun with. It's not meant to be a workshop. It's not meant to be a tryout. It's really just wanting to put a show on mm-hmm. with our friends, with people we like. And so when we do it at Theater for the New City, because we only rehearse for 2 weeks
wow.
in the evenings, and because we do it only for 24 performances, we don't invite critics to those, because it's a little unfair to everybody to rehearse so briefly, because you're not really paying anybody a lot of money. It's a stipend.
Yeah.
So, you know, for you work really hard, you work really fast, you work very honestly, very quickly and clearly, but you know, you have to be reviewed in the first weekend if it's going to do anything,
right.
if a review is going to mean anything. And usually we sell out. So mm-hmm. there's no, you know, real need, but you know, also if we get an opportunity to move it to another situation, you know, like with a not-for-profit theater, like Primary Stages or a drama department mm-hmm. or to a commercial run, like with Divine Sister, it's kind of nice to have it, you know, fresh.
Yes.
You know, it's a fresh property that it hasn't been reviewed in a sort of a showcase situation where it's just a little, it's a little too raw. Even though they come out great, it's a lot of pressure. And I think they come out great because we don't have that pressure
mm-hmm. yeah.
of, oh, and tonight's the, you know, we've had two previews and now we have the critics coming.
Right,
you
right.
You know, it's just, it's a lot. And usually these are meant to be experiences that are done for fun. And if it's meant to have another life, then so be it. And that's when it will be up for critical mm-hmm. review. You know, like I said, whether it's a not-for-profit review, of course, we have to fill more than 24 performances
right.
and more than 99 seats. So you do have to have the critical voice. And we want it. You know, we want to hear what the critics have to say. But, you know, when we've had like a full preview period, when we've had a full rehearsal period,
right.
when we're doing it in, you know, 2 weeks, including tech, oof, that's asking a lot.
Yeah, yes. Well, The Confession of Lily Dare is one show that has expanded to an off-Broadway run. It started at Theater for the New City last year, where you did the...
2018, actually.
Oh, 2018, yes, right.
We went into rehearsal in 2019.
Right. So that was in 2018, then it was the initial 24
yes.
performance run. So when after that run did you say, oh, let's have this be expanded to an open run? Well, it's not open. I mean, it's only going through March 5th, but a commercial run.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what had happened is Primary Stages, where Charles has done, we did our play, The Tribute Artist, there,
yes.
and he did his play, You Should Be So Lucky, and Olive and the Bitter Herbs.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has a relationship with Primary Stages, and I just love them over there. I love Andrew Lindsay. I love Aaron Daly. I love Casey Childs. And they actually wanted to do something with Charles in their 35th anniversary season.
Mm.
So they invited him to be a part of it, which was going to be in 2 years. And he was like, okay, well, and we thought maybe we might do a revival of one of his other plays, or who knows, Lily Dare didn't exist at that time.
Right.
But since we knew we weren't going to be having that slot for 2 years, well, maybe we should do something else. And so in that time, he wrote Lily Dare.
Mm.
We did the 24 performances. And while we were in it, he said to me, I really like doing this play. I really like playing this role. I would like to do it again. You know, it's not out of my system yet. So we talked to Primary Stages and we said, what do you think? And so they came to see the show and they thought he was marvelous and they thought it was marvelous. And so they said, yeah, let's make this what will be in that 35th anniversary slot. And so here we are.
That's
so
wonderful.
That's just sort of how the universe conspired to, you know, we had time, created a new play, had a good time doing it. Let's do it again.
Yes.
And then, and so it allowed us the a little bit of a miracle because it allowed us to work with the same cast.
Yes.
That they were all still available, you know, subsequently a year and a half, 2 years later.
Right.
That we got all of those people. So we got to just make it better.
Yeah.
Charles had a year to hone the script, mm-hmm. tighten things. What didn't work so well? What did he want to change? How could he make things better? We ended up keeping the length of each act exactly the same, but mm-hmm. there were a lot of changes, a lot of script changes. And then, you know, and to have a chance to have like a real rehearsal process and to go back and really reimagine the design elements and stuff like that for, you know, a proper production.
Yeah. Well, it's still fantastic because I saw it in 2018 and then I just saw it a week or two ago. And I love it. It's hilarious. It is fresh. I always love Charles Bush when he's a little campy. The cast is fantastic.
Did you cry?
Oh, come on. I don't normally cry. I'm not really a crier at things.
And that's something we just love, that an audience member can come. You can come and have a campy, bawdy old time, but you can also get caught up in the story. And that's why there's something for everyone in these plays.
Yes.
Even if you don't know what the movies are or anything like that. You know. So I like it when people are laughing, 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 and then weeping, 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 and then laughing. It's, you know, they're on the roller coaster with us.
Yes. Well, that's one thing too about this show, The Confession of Lily Dare, is there, like you said, there is a lot of laughs in it, but there is a really heartfelt story at the core of it. Yeah. And it is a beautiful story. And I don't want to make it seem like I was not invested in that part of it. So what do you love about directing this show?
I love working with this cast. They're so articulate. They're so intelligent. All of them are so smart, and they bring so many wonderful things to the table as far as their performances. They're all very funny, but they're also really great dramatic actors. And to do this material correctly, you have to be able to ride that roller coaster as a performer. And yet you have to be very disciplined, because it's very easy to go too far or play to laughs or, you know, wink at the audience. And we really pride ourselves on not doing that and playing, you know, really taking it very seriously, with a light heart, but also being very clear about what the humor is meant to be, you know, and paying attention to the music of Charles's language and finding the pathos along with the comedy. And I find that to be a winning combination, and especially working with these actors who so far exceeded my expectations about what the play was going to be. Charles is giving an extraordinary performance.
Yes.
Going from, you know, 16-year-old convent girl to, you know, lady in prison. You know, but no, for all the humor, there's just such depth of feeling that he's bringing to the part, that it's been glorious working with him on that and seeing where he's going and supporting him in that. And likewise, having this really talented cast of actors, Nancy Anderson, Howard McGillen, Christopher Borg, Kendall Sparks, Jennifer Van Dyke, really meeting him there and lifting him even further. It's just, I know it's a joy for him to play the funny stuff and the sincere stuff. And they're all just having such a good time doing it that I really don't tire of watching. You know, you have to watch the show a lot when you're a director. And I just so look forward to seeing what they're going to do, because it's always so fresh. So the big joy has been really working with the cast on this one.
Yeah, they're incredible. And everyone really brings their A game to the show.
There's, absolutely.
You know, and like you said, everyone, it's like everyone supports everyone and makes everyone shine so bright. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, there's no competitive edge for laughs. There's nothing like that. It's just, you know, and Charles is so generous as a writer, you know, and that he gives everybody a chance to shine, because his attitude is that their laughs are his laughs because it's his story.
Right.
So that just allows him to be extraordinarily generous constantly.
Yes, it's evident. You can tell. So now, what was the most challenging part to direct of the show?
Well, I think the most challenging thing in this one was coming up with the scenic plan, the mise en scène, as they say, because the play takes place in so many locations, and budgets are limited. We can't have a realistic set for every location,
right.
And the story moves so quickly that would just be an impossibility. So the challenge initially was to figure out, okay, where we're going to have a unit set, but where are we going to be? What do we want what do we want it to say? We knew we wanted to evoke San Francisco, because that's where the story is set. But, you know, when we were at Theater for the New City, we ended up in the biggest space that they have. We still only had 99 seats, but we had this big room to fill, which we hadn't had before. We'd always been in one of their smaller spaces, which is a little bit easier to fit a set in, you know, with a cast of six. But so this time, you know, we kind of had more space to fill and to justify. So when we did it at Theater for the New City, we sort of tried to evoke San Francisco, the wharf, you know, it was a series of platforms. We used, you know, like an evocation of the painted ladies. Everything was sort of meant to be seen as through the mist of memory. So everything was on a gray scale. And we had a big depiction of the Golden Gate Bridge in the back that we could light up when we wanted to see it and hide when we didn't want to see it. But it was ultimately not the right gesture. You know, we just sort of, but it was so big and expansive. And the story, even though it's a you know, sort of a grand story, it's very human.
Yes.
So we knew that when we were going to move it to primary stages, that we'd be at the Cherry Lane. And even if we wanted to do that set, we couldn't because we simply wouldn't have the space to do it. So it gave us a chance to reimagine. And so what did we want to depict this time? And having seen it for 24 performances and thinking like, okay, this big space, gray, meaning to, you know, the mists of memory, how can we adjust that for a smaller space? And my wonderful collaborator, Brian Whitehill, B.T. Whitehill, who's, you know, designed sets for Charles going back to Vampire Lesbians of Sodom, you know, and sets and graphics. He does a lot of posters too. He's just such a great collaborator. He's got such a keen eye and he's so smart. And I always feel like I, you know, gain a few IQ points back whenever I talk with Brian because he's so smart. And so we sort of really thought like, what can we fit into this jewel box? And so we sort of came up with the idea of wanting to have a bordello feel, a real sort of still in memory, but a sort of a bordello feel, a memory feeling, and, you know, and actually have missed this time, get fog machines with via our lighting designer Kirk Bookman, who we worked with a lot too, who's so wonderful, so talented, and again so clever and smart. But figuring out like what the space would be, how can we adapt what we did at Theater for the New City spatially to the smaller footprint. We still had a lot of, you know, costumes to make room for. And yet it had to be a unit set and allow us to sort of really move very swiftly. And I think what we came up with is very beautiful. It's very evocative of the feeling that we were going for. And I think it makes it just a little bit more intimate with what Brian's created. But it took us a lot of discussion and a lot of trial and error to figure out what would be the best unit set for this story that, you know, goes from, you know, a whorehouse to you know, to a nightclub, to prison, to so many different places, so many locations. What would help tell the story the best? And I think we really hit on something special.
Yes, I think you made great choices and the set really works very well.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
With directing the show, did your vision change at all from the premiere at Theater for the New City to this run at Cherry Lane Theater?
Well, I think what changed is having some time to sort of forget what we did at Theater for the New City. It was good for the actors. It was good for the designers. We sort of could take a step back and say what worked and where was there room for improvement. And, as you know, from everything from the script to the clothes to the lighting to the scenic plan, so that was the generosity of that time of being part of that 35th anniversary season. You know, we really had a year and a half to think like, well, where is there room for improvement? And the script, you know, I think we figured out that Charles sort of eliminated 15 pages and then added it back in, but not so as you would notice. The first act is still under an hour. The second act is still under 45 yeah. minutes. You know, it really is a 2-hour evening. It just got tighter. It just got stronger.
Okay, so we're going to switch gears real quick.
Yes.
And we're going to play a game.
Oh, gosh.
Based upon the film A Very Serious Person, which is the film that you and Charles co-wrote together.
Yes.
And co-starred in. So in this game, I'm going to list names of some people you have worked with. And you are going to tell me one serious thing about them and one funny thing about them.
Okay.
Or one funny thing that they did that made you laugh. So we're going to start with, of course, Charles Bush.
All right. Well, on the serious side of things, you know, Charles really has been my greatest influence and my closest friend.
Mm.
And, you know, I just, you know, he's an extremely important relationship in my life. So, you know, heartfelt, serious side of
yes.
things, that's really true. But he's also the funniest people I know, you know, and we just be on the phone for 10 minutes and there's, you know, like 16 good laughs, you know. But I think one of my funniest memories of Charles is from when we first met, actually, and we were sort of a few months into him playing in Swingtime Canteen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was very young and I was on the wardrobe. And so I was, you know, doing the laundry and, you know, there's a lot of just like labor that goes into being the head of wardrobe and maintaining mm-hmm. the wigs. And I made new replacement costumes, altered costumes for when there was cast changes or understudies came in. So I was, you know, very,
wow.
very busy. And there was one, you know, particular day where, you know, he was getting ready for the evening show and I came in and I said, boy, I really feel like I'm paying my dues in this business. You know, and Charles just sort of put down the eyebrow pencil and looked at me with a cold, hard eye in the mirror and said, don't you talk to me about paying your dues in this business. Girl, until you make your money on your back as a whore or a stripper, then you can come to me and talk to me about paying dues. Girl.
Oh my God, I could hear him saying that. I love it.
I mean, apropos of nothing, but that was just so funny.
Yeah.
It was just like, but that's his, you know, he turned into Susan Hayward and was absolutely hilarious. And, you know, how do you not love a guy like that? I mean, it's just that's your pal.
Yes. It's incredible. Let's go to Julie Halston.
Well, Julie is just, she's just one of the greatest human beings
yes.
there is. You know, she's so funny, but she, you know, she's also dealt with some tremendous personal loss in recent
mm-hmm.
years. It's been difficult, but she's just such a good person. And one of the greatest things she's done is in dealing with her late husband, Ralph Howard's battle with pulmonary fibrosis,
mm-hmm.
she, with him, they really started this benefit that we've been doing for the last 10 years called Broadway Belts for Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation. And we started it because, you know, we were given the gift of Ralph getting a replacement lung
yes.
and having that transplant. And then we got 8 more years with him. And so, you know, Julie is just, she's a great woman
mm-hmm.
who has made that happen and really shone a light on this terrible affliction. And she touches a lot of lives through that.
Yeah.
So
she does.
But on the funny side, again, you have a 10-minute phone conversation with Julie and there's 16 good laughs.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just everything from her vocal delivery to her sense of humor
mm-hmm.
to her observations, just like with Charles. That's why they're such a good team.
Yes.
Is because they're just so funny and she cracks you up. And to this day, you know, whenever we're sort of hanging up the phone or saying goodbye after a dinner or something, Julie will look at me and she'll say, we'll always have L.A. And that just goes back to a few years ago when we were recording The Divine Sister for LA Theater Works.
Mm.
We were out there for a week and we're putting the play on tape, which was great fun. And at the same time, Julie, Charles, and I were sharing a house. We were basically staying at Andrew Rannell's house
oh
in
God.
Hollywood while he was on the East Coast. So it sort of worked out perfectly. And I was sort of the chauffeur driving us back and forth from the house in Hollywood to the UCLA campus. And we would just go through and just Julie's observations of, you know, everything that was Holly weird. And I just remember at that time there was a new book coming out about the Manson family
mm-hmm.
murders, and Julie has been obsessed with that story. Her, like, ever because she was a young person, she was like a teenager or something
yeah.
when that was happening, and so just knowing all the details, all the facts about it. And, you know, it's some, and it was always something I never wanted to know about. Yeah. It was always very scary to me. I could see commercials for Helter Skelter on TV, and I was just always terrified of that story as a child. I avoided it, whereas Julie knew everything.
Yeah.
So finally, I was like, Julie, we're driving. And I said, Julie, I heard that there's this new book coming out about the Manson family. And she said, I've ordered it. It's on its way through Amazon. I cannot wait because it's going to, you know, clear up this discrepancy or that discrepancy, you know. And I said, well, Julie, you know, could you give me the timeline of like what happened? Because I've always avoided that story.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about it. I don't want to read that book. But could you give me the timeline? And she started to shake. And she said, Carl, you have made my life. We will sit poolside and I will tell you the story. Funny thing about that was Charles finally came out, joined us at the poolside and was telling the story. And, you know, we were all just so rapt and we got so terrified and we skeeved ourselves out that here we were, you know, very close to where it all had gone down.
Yeah.
And so we were like, we're going to go inside. And I locked the door and we spent the next hour watching Punchy Players videos because we needed to change the tone. We needed a palate cleanser.
I was going to say.
We were laughing hysterical. And again, it's the roller coaster.
Yeah.
Very, very dark, very serious. Here are the facts. To laughing, laughing, laughing. Well, when it was time for me to sort of, I had to go to like this other pool house. Open the door and the alarm system had been set. And in the middle of the night, it's just going off crazy. Charles is melting into a pile. It's so loud. And Julie is just screaming the code. I get the code in. And then we just died laughing for, you know, the next half hour. It was just so ridiculous. So, you know, that was such a bonding experience. And Julie said, we'll always have LA. And then later that fall, we went into rehearsals for The Tribute Artist, you know, a play we did together, which was such great fun. So yeah, that's that's just one of the many funny things that Julie will always crack me up with.
I love it. A personal favorite of mine, Kathy Lee Gifford.
Oh, Kathy Lee Gifford was, you know, it's very sort of brief interaction with her. Basically, Charles had this opportunity to direct a short film for Showtime. Years ago, and it was called Personal Assistant. It was just like sort of like a 10-minute film, and we talked about the story together, and then they got Kathy Lee Gifford to star in it, really great fun. And so Charles was directing it, and I had a little part in it, and I just remember it was what led to A Very Serious Person happening. There was one place where in the script her character was supposed to say something like, you know, God damn it, something, something, something. And she really didn't want to say God damn it. She's such a woman of faith that it was really important that she not take the Lord's name in vain.
Right.
And you have to respect that. But she was so sweet about it that she said, you know, I'll say anything else you want. I'll say fuck. I'll say shit. I'll say the C word. You know, and she would say anything. But, you know, it really didn't matter. She could say, you know, dang it. It wasn't important. But she wanted to respect the writer, but she just really didn't want to take the Lord's name in vain. And it was so, so sweet, but it was very, very dear and funny, you know.
I love that.
At the same time.
I love that.
Kathy Lee. But she was great fun.
Yeah.
She was like, she showed up early. She knew all her lines. Mm-hmm. She was excellent. We had, you know, Jim Caruso was in that. Julie was in that. Wow. Mario Cantone was in that.
Oh,
we
my
had
God.
A great, great day. And and she was just a game gal, and she stayed late and, you know, and she wore her own clothes and did her own makeup, and she's great, great fun.
Yeah, I've heard really good things about her work ethic, and
she's terrific.
Yeah. Legendary Cheetah Rivera.
Well, that was one of the happiest times of my life. When the Actors Fund was going to do a concert of The Visit, and my dear friend Tim Pinckney, who was producing it for the Actors Fund, invited me to direct the concert, and that was just extraordinary. And it was going to star Cheetah, and so the great thing was that I had to be sort of vetted by Terrence McNally, who I'd met over the years, and John Kander, who I'd never met, and Cheetah Rivera, who I'd never met. But so once they all sort of agreed that I could do the show, they had to meet me.
Yeah.
So I remember going, you know, to Terrence's apartment, and, you know, sort of him getting comfortable with me. And when I said, you know, here's what I think we'll do. Oh, and then he opened up and he was very excited. Mm-hmm. And just, we spent like 2 hours talking about the show. Then the next morning was breakfast with John Kander. You know, I go to his house and, you know, sort of starts off like, you know, okay, hello. And then explaining, you know, what we're going to do and how I see this concert. And then he opened up and got very excited. And it was just like, ah, good. Number three was Cheetah. Mm. So lunch with Cheetah.
Oh, my God.
And we went to West Bank, and Tim and I were going to have lunch with her. And so we were waiting there in the booth. And she showed up and she looked very serious. And she had a hat on and sort of sat in the booth and looked at me, fixed me with a very serious looking gaze. And then she goes, "What the hell are we doing?" And then she collapsed into my arms and said, "Please take care of me." And we just laughed. Oh, and we spent the next 2 hours talking about what the show was going to be and, you know, what would make her happy and how we could best, you know, support her mm-hmm. in revisiting this role. And we just laughed for 2 hours and we had the best time. And those 2 weeks working with her and with Anne Ryan King, who was choreographing, was just such a gift to me to spend time with that group and that material. And we had such a ball and it was extraordinary. She got a 5-minute standing ovation just by entering the top of the play.
That doesn't surprise me.
So wonderful. So that was extraordinary. And like, she just, you know, that's the funny thing about, you know, she's such a wonderful and elegant lady, you know? So, you know, what's serious about her is her talent and her legend and her legacy. And what's funny about her is just her warmth. And she's so open and divine, and we'll talk about anything. But the funny story here, I do remember the memory, is we're at the Sitzprobe for the visit. So we're hearing those glorious orchestrations at Carol Music, and where the conductor says, "Okay, everybody, number 17. And Cheetah just spread her legs wide and said, "The Spread Eagle." and the room full of, you know, 40 people just died.
Oh,
you know, she's just like, you know, bringing back Chicago and the recording. And we just thought that was heaven, you know, just like that kind of person, that legendary lady, just having such a good time and so thrilled to be doing what she's doing and just like playful. Yeah. So anyway, that about Cheetah.
Yeah.
It was just so, so funny. Number 17. Number 17, everybody, the Spread Eagle. She went into the splits. It was just heaven, just pure heaven.
And finally, we have Kathleen Turner.
Oh, Kathleen. That was great fun meeting Kathleen and getting to work with her when we did the third story in New York. And I just got such a kick out of her. And she's so, you know, frank and honest and clean, you know, in her thinking. And I just, it just really liked her forthright attitude, you know? Yeah, what was so great about Kathleen is, you know, it's like she's dealt with her struggle with rheumatoid arthritis like a champ, you know, and really speaks about it and is very frank about her experiences. And I think that kind of honesty removes the stigma of dealing with being in chronic pain and understanding it. And I just really applaud her stamina. And also I applaud her fun attitude. You know, we did the third story and I really loved working with her on that. And then, and subsequently she did a benefit for me, a benefit reading of a play called Hollywood Nurses. And she's just such a game lady and so fun. And I'm so thrilled that she's having this resurgence with her cabaret career. I think it's just wonderful. But, you know, one of the interesting things that was kind of serious and that was kind of funny, when we were doing the third story, after we had opened, she, you know, she had been dealing with, she'd like needed a knee operation of some kind. But at the Lortel, it was just nothing but stairs. And so, you know, you had to go up the stairs to get to the dressing room, downstairs to get to the deck, and then upstairs to get to the set. And it was just a lot of stairs. Well, one night coming from intermission, coming from the dressing room, something clicked in her knee and she did the whole second act. Her knee blew up like a balloon.
Oh my God.
And, you know, we had to get her to the hospital and we were a little worried. We're like, oh my God, what if she can't come back? And we were really nervous. And then we were trying to think like, what could happen, you know? And then we sort of came up with this nutty notion of, well, maybe Charles could play his, you know, two of his roles and one of her roles, and then I would come back and I would play one of his roles and one of her roles and something like that. We figured all out. We kind of worked it out, and we thought, wait, yeah, this could work if she can't come back, if she's incapacitated because of the knee, if the doctor, you know, if she needs surgery, whatever. And so we talked it through with the producers, we talked it through with the cast, we actually rehearsed it. We were gonna try it, because we were waiting to see what was going to happen with her. And of course, that night after we came up with this notion, you know, I was sort of vomiting all night, and Charles had a bloody nose, and we're just like, oh, this is just a terrible idea. Oh God, what are we going to do? Phone rings at 7 o'clock in the morning, and it's Kathleen. And she's like, I hope you don't do anything rash. Talk to my doctor. And the doctor said, let her use a cane. If you can build a ramp so that she can get up to the stage and not have to deal with the steps. And if she can wear, you know, sort of like these orthopedic shoes that are black, that'll be fine. She can do the show. She can come back in 2 days.
Wow.
And she's like, I'm coming back. And I said to her, you know, like what we had come up with. And she said, nonsense. Nobody's playing my part but me. And it was funny. It made international news. You know, Kathleen Turner, you know, continues with the show, which I loved. You know, my dad calls me and he said, I'm in the newspaper, man. He's like, I'm singing the New Zealand Times. Like, Kathleen Turner is a trooper. And I'm like, she sure is. But subsequently, after she was back in the show and we made all those adjustments so that she could, you know, we made a special dressing room for her and made the ramp. And but she would have to exit the theater after the show through the front of the house because it was, you know, the most level way to go so that she wouldn't have to climb stairs. And there were always people waiting to stage door for her. They always wanted her to sign things. People would, you know, hand her a baseball.
Mm-hmm.
She'd sign it. You know, people would give Kathleen anything they could to sign just to get, because she's a huge movie star, you know. And it's like everything from a baseball to one night as I was helping her get into her car, this gentleman came up to her and put a poster in front of her and asked her to sign it. And he said, this is for all the gays and lesbians in Chicago. And she looked at him and said, all of them? And he said, yes. And she signed it and she said, give him my best. I was like, that's a star.
That is.
That's a star. Yeah, so I really love Kathleen.
So we're just going to go with the last few questions.
Okay.
So since the game was based on the movie A Very Serious Person, we're going to quickly talk about A Very Serious Person because I'm actually going to see it on Sunday at the New York Indie Theater Film Festival, which I'm very excited about. So what was it like to co-write and co-star in the film as opposed to write and act in a stage production?
Oh, it was a dream come true. You know, Charles and I share an affinity for movies and just, you know, love the concept of movies. And so when we were given this opportunity to actually make a movie, it was magical. Mm-hmm. It was really magical. And it came about because our friend Daryl Roth, you know, who's produced many of our plays, saw the personal assistant short subject that Charles made with Kathy Lee Gifford. She thought it was wonderful. And she said, you know, if you ever like an opportunity to make a feature, write a story and let me know.
Oh my God.
And so then Charles said to me, he's like, we got to write a story, kid. So then we wrote this movie and then we rewrote it a couple of times and then gave it to her and she loved it. She loved the subject matter. And she said, I think we should make this movie. And we said, okay. And this was probably like February. And we said, okay, when? She said, this summer. And then, you know, very quickly put the production together and we spent a month, you know, making that movie. And then we spent, you know, a couple of months editing it. And she was just divine during the whole process. And so what's interesting is that, you know, you spend a lot of time, just as much time writing a screenplay. Mm-hmm. But what we learned in going backwards afterwards is that in your rewriting and your editing was, you know, we had to make it more visual because you're writing for the camera and it's not so dialogue heavy.
Mm.
So that was a very interesting lesson about writing. And then what's so interesting about performing for film, especially in a low budget film that you're taking, you know, you have a very limited amount of time and a lot of shooting you got to do. When you're doing a play, if it doesn't work Tuesday night, You can fix it Wednesday night. You get another shot at it. And so, but with film, you really have to get it right before you move on because there's really never any time to come back to it. So, you know, you, and when you're in the editing room, you can really see, like, in those early days of shooting where, oh gosh, if we'd only gotten a little bit more coverage or if the lighting was a little different, and you really can't go back.
Right.
So even though there's the freedom to get it right, you really got to make sure you know exactly what you want it to look like all together. But before you leave that shot. So it was a very interesting thing. And of course we had a wonderful team. We had a wonderful cast. So it was really, as much fun doing that movie as any of our plays were. But that was really the difference. You know, the one is very ephemeral and one is forever. You know?
Yes. Well, I can't wait to see it. I'm so excited.
I love doing that movie.
What are some other projects you have coming up?
Well, I'm very hopeful that I'll get a chance to do a production of this wonderful play that we did a reading of with Kathleen called Hollywood Nurses that we did a few years ago. And I've been working on that project for a long time, and we're hoping to find a place to do it this year. And we're in talks, so that's great. That's written by Sheila Head and Peter Michael Marino, is a great friend, and both of them.
Interviewing him in a few weeks.
Show up, kids. No, he's great. He and Sheila wrote this play, and they found me during Shanghai Moon, so we've been sort of like you know, in each other's pockets since then. So great friends, and done various, you know, workshops and whatnot of that show. And so I think we're getting a little closer to having a chance during a production.
That's terrific.
And that's exciting. And last year in Miami, I did a play called Fake. It was written by my dear friend Carmen Palais, and about it's set in the art world, and about fakes and her. Her great aunt, Amelia Pelaez, was one of the foremost modernist painters from Cuba.
Oh, wow.
And so it very much reflects her experience of, you know, sort of what do you do when what you see before you could be a fake. And so it was a very, we did a beautiful production with Miami New Drama last year. And we're trying to find other opportunities to do that play because I really loved another chance to, you know, have a wider audience see that.
Oh, terrific.
And then Charles and I are actually working on another movie script.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we want to get back into pictures.
Yes.
So we're working on a story and hopefully within the next year we'll be making another movie.
That's terrific. Yeah. Well, if you need an interviewer in the movie,
hey,
I'm available.
I know where to come.
Exactly. Well, we are up to the last question, which I can't believe already. So I always end my interviews playing off of the title of my podcast, Burying It All with Call Me Adam. So if you could bear it all and reveal something about yourself that you have not told in a previous interview, what would you tell me today?
Well, this is a real hard question because I feel like I'm such an open book.
Yes.
You know, anybody can ask me anything. Maybe I'll tell you. But like, I don't know. I don't feel like I have so many secrets. But I think what something's unusual is that I'm a big fan of women's basketball.
Oh.
I love the WNBA.
Who's your favorite team?
Connecticut Sun.
Oh, okay.
Connecticut Sun, yeah. We have a personal connection to the Connecticut Sun. My dear friend Amber is the vice president of the team. So she is my husband Christopher's one of his closest friends from high school.
Oh, wow.
And she is she's always been in women's athletics.
Uh-huh.
And a couple years ago she and her wife moved east and they work for the WNBA, and when they were in New York we'd get to go and see like Liberty games.
Oh, wow.
And you know, sit courtside, which, you know, you feel like Spike Lee. It's just so exciting. She runs the Connecticut Sun, and they were in the finals last year.
Oh, my gosh.
Super, super exciting. Excellent, excellent team. And it's funny, like, I was so unathletic growing up. And I mean, I'm slightly more athletic now, but team sports were never, ever my thing. But seeing the game through my friend Amber and Kyle's eyes, it just opened it up to me, and it's very exciting. It's very strategic. It's very strong and athletic. And these women are incredible, incredible, just to watch these athletes up and down the court, especially if you're lucky enough to sort of be close
right.
and see the speed at which they're going and their strength and their height and their power. It's just, it's mesmerizing and it's thrilling. So I tell everybody, you got to go see a WNBA game.
Well, we will.
Go, go, go. Yes. Go, go, go.
Well, that's the whole interview. So thank you very much.
Thank
for
you,
your
Adam.
Time.
Thanks for
you're
asking
welcome.
Me. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. And everybody listening to this podcast, you are going to get tickets for The Confession of Lily Dare, which is at the Cherry Lane Theater here in New York City, and it's running through March 5th. And that's it.
He'll get the dirt and the scoop and the story, for he happens to be in the know. Just ask anybody who's Adam. Adam lives for the business of show. CallMeAdam.com.
Thanks for listening. For more Call Me Adam interviews, visit CallMeAdam.com. And follow me on social media on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at CallMeAdamNYC.
Do you remember watching your favorite celebrity being interviewed, but you could tell there was more to that interview than what was being shown? My name is Adam Rothenberg, and in the past 16 years, I have interviewed over 2,200 artists and celebrities. And I am here to tell you that yes, there is definitely more to the interviews you have watched, read, or listened to. In my debut book, Behind the Curtain, The Mistakes, Lessons Learned, and Triumphs of Interviewing Celebrities, I take you behind the scenes of what really happens during an interview, sharing the joys, the pitfalls, and the OMG moments. You can get your copy on Amazon or through my entertainment platform, CallMeAdam.com, you can get your very own autographed copy.